So once, when I was at a minister's conference in Asilomar down near Carmel, I decided during a break in the programming to go see the Monarch Butterfly Preserve in Pacific Grove, which I had heard about for years but never had gone to see. This is an area, actually it's two small areas, in Pacific Grove where the migrating monarch butterflies come to breed after traveling immensely long distances with the seasons. These particular butterflies, summer in the Rocky Mountains and winter in Pacific Grove. Interestingly, the butterflies that return to Pacific Grove are not the same ones who left. They are the great-great-grandchildren of the ones who bred around the eucalyptus trees in the Grove Preserve a year earlier. So it's their great-great-grandchildren who come back. It's just so amazing to me. It's astonishing that these butterflies who have never been to the preserve themselves nevertheless make their way back to that same ancestral breeding ground every year. What wondrous things occur in the natural world. Well, I drove around there following the map that I had picked up that showed the way to the two preserves, and I drove past the one I was looking for several times because although the map indicated that it was there, I couldn't see it. All I saw was a thin stretch of eucalyptus trees wedged in between some houses. That can't be it, I said to myself, expecting something larger and more set apart from people's homes. But after I finally got out of the car and walked among the trees, the miracle unfolded right before my eyes. There were thousands of the butterflies high, high up in the trees, fluttering in the air. And there were a few people like me gazing up in astonishment. At the same time that I felt elated to have found this natural wonder, I also felt sad. Sad that this little strip of prime real estate, and one other no bigger than this one, is all the land in that area that we have set aside out of the original thousands of acres to allow these magnificent creatures to continue their ancient mating dance and migratory habits. This sad tale is, of course, a story that has been iterated countless times over the eons. A habitat that is just right for a particular set of species develops in conjunction with the species in a complex chain of evolution and adaptation. And then, in just a few years, or maybe a generation, humans come and take over the habitat, driving the plants and animals there into smaller and smaller spaces, and often into extinction as the habitat disappears. We humans have changed the earth on a scale that far surpasses the changes any other animals have made. We continue to eliminate habitat, thus changing the kinds of animals and plants that can survive in specific areas all over the planet. We have lowered and polluted water tables, shrunk forests and expanded deserts. We have changed the Earth's very climate by the massive burning of fossil fuels, trapping gases in the atmosphere, creating what's now widely known as the greenhouse effect, which is, as we also widely know now, warming up the Earth. Scientists have been warning us for years about the changes that this will produce. The expansion of desert areas, a rise in the sea level resulting in coastal flooding as polar ice melts, a disruption of agriculture and stress on large areas of forest land, fires due to drought conditions which will wipe out yet more forests. These climate changes due to global warming, which most scientists believe are already fully underway, will have dire consequences for us if they continue. And we've already seen many of the effects. The ocean waters have warmed by a full degree Fahrenheit since 1970, and warmer waters produce more and fiercer hurricanes. We have certainly seen that in the past few years. In fact, the number of level 4 and 5 hurricanes has more than doubled in the past 40 years. Global warming will also lead to increased deaths from heat waves and insect-borne diseases, as well as from drinking water contaminated by floods. So we humans have already changed the landscape and the very climate by our actions. We have even had a hand in changing time itself, as I learned from a ministerial colleague who is an environmental scientist as well. Our Earth is gradually slowing down in its rotation. This is a natural process, so that over time, a day, one rotation, is getting longer. Apparently, our habit of damming up flowing waterways has changed the nature of the moon's gravitational pull on the ocean tides by reducing the amount of water in the oceans that the moon pulls on. This is causing the Earth's natural slowing down in its day-long rotation cycle to slow less rapidly. The difference is very slight and can only be measured with very precise clocks. But it does illustrate that our rearranging of the natural environment does have an impact on this small, precious planet. The many planetary changes we are responsible for are like the Earth crying out to us, trying to warn us. We need to turn things around before it's too late. The Earth is our teacher, but more of us need to wake up and pay attention. And there is some awakening going on, more and more each year. Now, 192 nations have ratified the Kyoto Treaty to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, though unfortunately our nation, which produces 25% of those emissions, wasn't one of the ratifiers. But there has been a U.S. Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement, and that's in line with the Kyoto Protocol. That was signed by 2,060 mayors, has been signed by that many mayors so far around the country. And this has already resulted in some new light rail and green energy alternatives in those cities, plus miles of new bikeways and the retrofitting of schools and low-income housing developments for greater energy efficiency. Although I'm a born and bred big city dweller, I recognize in myself a hunger, a need to have some connection to nature. My love of astronomy is one manifestation of this need. And to really do amateur astronomy right, you need to get at least away from the concentration of city lights somewhere. I feel disconnected from the natural world when I don't get a chance every so often to get reconnected through my astronomy habit. I need to place myself in some sort of undeveloped area to really do this, in some natural setting. When I lived in New York City as a youngster, I rarely got out to the country. I remember fantasizing as a little kid going to school that the sidewalk walks that I was traversing on my way to the school were actually paths through the woods. This all went on in my mind. And a tree typically surrounded by a city-style little fence became, in my imagination, a whole forest. I was nature-deprived, as so many of us are, so I compensated in my mind. I would also catch crickets, fireflies, and ladybugs in a jar and bring them home until my parents finally decided that I should have a pet. But the only type of pet I could have in our small city apartment complex was a very small one with a self-contained habitat, like a bird or a hamster or a lizard. So my parents bought me a parakeet, and I became very attached to that bird. Ever since, until fairly recently, I've had some kind of pet, and I've become deeply attached to each one of them. I recently came across a book by the famous sociobiologist Edward O. Wilson. That book explained to me my need for nature. He theorizes that human beings have an innate urge to connect with non-human forms of life. Wilson goes as far as to say this about it. He says our existence depends on this propensity. Our spirit is woven from it. Hope rises on its currents. Wilson calls this idea the biophilia hypothesis. But even if there is an innate tendency among us to focus on living things, our modern lifestyles seem to be suppressing this inclination. A study involving inhabitants of the Sonoran Desert found that the elders among the subjects, which included Ootam and Yaqui Indians, as well as Anglos and Hispanics, that the elders in all those groups in the Sonoran Desert have far more intimate connection with and knowledge of the local flora and fauna than do their grandchildren. The grandchildren learn mostly about nature from books and television, not from being there and recognizing what's in front of them. We need to get back into a closer contact with the natural world, to look under the pavement and beyond the walls, to listen away from the constant drone of machines and automobiles, to let the earth teach us as it taught generations of those before us. We need to expose our children to the great gift of nature so that they may become attuned to the lessons of the earth and not just distracted by the bright lights of the city. Two medical researchers, Aaron Katcher and Gregory Wilkins, have looked into the biophilia hypothesis and suggested that children who throw stones at birds and children who feed birds are both responding to what may be an innate tendency to focus their attention on natural things, on living things. The question is, how can we channel our human tendency to connect with other living things toward constructive, peaceful coexistence rather than destructiveness? I believe that turning ourselves around, cultivating a constructive connection with nature, needs to start with each one of us. We need to teach our children and grandchildren to feel their innate connection with other living things in a sympathetic way by growing plants, caring for pets, getting out into nature, learning about ecology, and taking action to save species and habitats from disappearing. Right here on this church, on the church grounds, our children have taken a very keen interest in the monarch butterflies that have bred here and gone through their life cycle. And it's very exciting to watch them be so excited about witnessing this process and creating a habitat that will sustain it and increase it. When I was a child, it used to greatly upset me to see children mistreating animals. So I was determined to give my own child a sense of intimate connection to nature by visiting the natural world with him, by exposing him to books and TV programs about nature, and finding pets and houseplants he could help take care of. He was also fortunate to attend schools in which there was encouragement to learn about and connect directly with nature. When he was just 7 years old, he learned about the plight of the endangered manatees of Florida, the gentle creatures of the shallow coastal waters who are being maimed and killed by motorboats and who now number only a few thousand, due to our continued encroachment upon their habitat. My son's concern for these creatures led to small-scale activism that was entirely his idea. He got people to sign up to sponsor a manatee. He set up a lemonade stand in our neighborhood. And doing these things, he became one more child who would never throw stones at birds, but who would act on their behalf instead. Collectively, we in the U.S. are throwing stones at birds through our consumptive, wasteful, and unreflective lifestyles. It is astounding to realize that in order to sustain all of the world's 7.5 billion people at the same level that we in this country enjoy, the same use of resources, using current technology, if we were to sustain all the people on the earth the way we are sustained in terms of our lifestyles, we would need to use the natural resources of 2 additional Earths. 2 whole Earths. Scientists have discovered that there are other Earths, other planets circling other stars, but whether they have resources which can support life is unknown, and they are very, very far away. The other planets in our solar system most likely cannot currently support life as we know it, or at least they don't support complex forms of life. So where it for this little corner of space? Ours is, to twist the old circus phrase, the greatest Earth on show. And it's up to us, individually and collectively, to make sure that this little planet we are messing with and altering can continue to support life, life that is self-sustaining. The good news from the environmental movement is that we can all make a significant difference. This is one social cause that really does, in some important ways, come down to you and me and the choices that we make. Whenever you throw a can into the recycling bin instead of the trash, or walk or take a bus or train instead of drive, or choose green products to clean with instead of harsh, polluting chemicals, or eat lower on the food chain, eat more vegetable sources of protein and less meat, or choose a hybrid car, then I say you are performing a sacred act, as deeply spiritual as any ritual or tradition or prayer has ever been. Your sacred act acknowledges that this planet is a precious and holy place, and you are acknowledging your own responsibility to this great earth we live on. On this greatest earth on show, there are positive signs that we are learning what this precious planet can teach us, that we can't keep messing around with the delicate balance that sustains us. May we continue this hard learning before it's too late. These closing words are those of Jeffrey Kluger from a recent article on global warming in Time magazine. In a solar system crowded with sister worlds that either emerged stillborn like Mercury or Venus, or died in infancy like Mars, we're finally coming to appreciate the knife blade margins within which we can thrive. For more than a century, we've been monkeying with these margins. It's long past time we set them right.